This is the second day of this July 2013 seven-day session. And we'll resume reading from our text of yesterday, which is the teachings of the 19th and 20th century Chinese Zen master Xu Yun. And the little book that I'm reading from is called Empty Cloud, The Teachings of Xu Yun. Empty Cloud is his was his Dharma name. It's translation, I guess, of Xu Yun. what's one of the most notable things about Xu Yun was the length of his life. He lived to be just over 101. He saw a lot of changes in China. So we read the first chapter yesterday of his teaching. Here's the second chapter. These are his words. Many people begin Chan training. Chan, of course, is Zen. By thinking, well, since all is Maya or samsaric illusion, it doesn't matter what I do or how I do it. The only thing that's important is gaining nirvana. So, since there's no such thing as good or evil, I'll do what I want. By the way, I don't think I've ever encountered anyone in Western Zen who thinks that way. I take that back. There are those who after many, many years of practice, convince themselves that because they've seen to the emptiness of all phenomena, including all morality, that they can do whatever they want. Those are rare exceptions. It seems to have been more of a problem in China, in Asia generally, than it is here. But then he says, it does matter what we do. Chan is a branch of the Buddhist religion, and as Buddhists, we must adhere to ethical precepts. Samsara or no samsara, we obey the precepts. And in addition to this, we also follow the strict rules of discipline which govern our training. Let's start with the training rules. While there are many different methods that may be followed, before beginning any of them, a practitioner must meet four basic requirements. He or she must, 1, understand the law of causality, 2, accept the rules of discipline, 3, maintain an unshakable faith in the existence of the true self, and 4, be determined to succeed in whichever method he chooses. And then for these next few pages, he goes through these four prerequisites. First, the law of causality simply states that evil produces evil and good produces good. A poison tree yields poison fruit, while a healthy tree yields good. Conceptually, this appears to be simple, but in actuality, it is rather complex. This word evil is one that always makes me wince. It sounds so, well, evil. And also, it can, when you see that word, you can think, okay, well, what I'm doing, when I'm breaking the precepts, when I'm causing harm, it's not, what I'm doing really isn't evil, so, you know, it's not that bad. Trouble is, can't find quite the right word. We use the word evil, we draw our repentance ceremony from the repentance ceremony presented by Zen Master Dogen, and we've kept the word evil. I keep procrastinating about changing it, but not just procrastination, because there's nothing, it's such a simple, short word. A better word might be misdeeds, that misdeeds produce not evil, but pain or suffering when we violate the precepts, that we cause suffering. The precepts are just are an articulation of rules by which we can avoid hurting people. We don't need to get into a big thing about good and evil. We just want to avoid causing harm, hurting others. That's all. That's pretty simple. We don't want to cause harm to others. We don't want to cause harm to ourselves. He continues, evil deeds are a vile investment. They guarantee a return in pain, bitterness, anxiety, and remorse. There is no profit to be had from actions that spring from greed, anger, delusion, pride, laziness, or jealousy. All such motivations merely serve the ego's ambitions. Evil deeds can never produce spiritual fulfillment. They only guarantee spiritual poverty. So let's just bring this down to something in Sesshin. We have all these rules in Sesshin, rules and procedures that we've hammered out over some 45 years or so now. And these are designed to enable everyone to function most effectively and practice most effectively. As I said in the opening ceremony, the structure of all the Sesshin guidelines and rules, that structure creates a container and a safety where people can relax most deeply and count on not being disturbed by others. So they're very important, not just in Sesshin, but any kind of Zen training, or probably any kind of spiritual training. They help us practice better if everyone can follow them. New people, and sometimes more senior people, will break these guidelines sometimes inadvertently, just out of ignorance. They do something that can create waves, partly sometimes because when they're new, they don't realize how many waves we can create by doing things carelessly or mindlessly. And those things, people are just corrected. The monitors will just correct them, or I'll correct them. It's like hitting the bell too hard when going to Doksan. No one deliberately tries to hurt other people's ears by hitting the bell too hard. They just need to have a kind of a correction. But then there are from time to time people who deliberately break the rules just for their own ego-centered preferences. Every once in a while we catch someone taking a shower when it's not their assigned time, or doing something else. It's just pure self-centeredness. And this is so foolish, because what they come to Sesshin for is to work on purifying the mind of self-centeredness, and yet they're working against themselves and they do things like this. So it's the deliberate, conscious, sneaky violation of Sesshin rules that are the only ones where the monitors or I can get angry about those kind of things. It's basically what he's saying when he says evil deeds only guarantee spiritual poverty. They don't promote fulfillment. On the other hand, he says, good deeds, provided they are not done conditionally as an investment that will yield some future reward, good deeds will bring to the doer of them peace and fulfillment. An egoless good deed is very different from a contrived good deed. On the surface, the effect may seem the same. Help or kindness that is needed is given. But the person who helps another with the hidden expectation of receiving some future benefit usually does harm, not good. And then he tells a fairly long story that I couldn't really quite relate to, and I'm guessing that other people wouldn't either, so I'm going to skip that. But then he comes back to his point. Perform a good deed in silence and anonymity. Forget about rejoicing. A good deed should have a very short life, and once dead, should be quickly buried. Let it rest in peace. Don't keep trying to resuscitate it. Too often we try to turn a good deed into a ghost that haunts people, that keeps reminding them of our wonderful service, just in case they start to forget. You know, there is a little kind of subtle humor sprinkled in here that I started to catch on to. Humor is such a can be so different in different nationalities, and but I hope people can appreciate some of the humor he brings in here. But what happens when we are the recipient of someone else's kindness? Well, then, we ought to let that good deed gain immortality. Letting someone else's good deeds live is much more difficult than letting our own good deeds die. I once heard that in Japan, the etiquette around giving and receiving is so highly refined, and you're expected after receiving a gift from someone to mention it over and over again into the future each time you see the person. I'm sure that wouldn't be for every kind of gift, but the spirit of it is that you let the person know that you haven't forgotten it. There is in Asia and some Asian countries, maybe all Asian countries, a custom of being careful not to thank people too much, because the idea is that if we thank people for things they've done, then they receive less merit for it, especially in the case of where monks are the recipients. I've often heard about when lay people give money or food or something to the monks in Asia, they don't want to be thanked, because it reduces the merit that they would receive by giving to monks. And then I'm skipping another fairly long story. And he says, how often, when we want something badly, do we promise that if we are given what we desire, we will dedicate our lives to demonstrate our gratitude? But then, once we receive what we so ardently sought, our pledge weakens and dies almost automatically. We quickly bury it without ceremony. This is not the Zen way. When we receive what we so ardently sought, our pledge weakens and dies. I'm reminded of a story someone told me about a movie from the 1970s maybe, starring Burt Reynolds, where he somehow gets pitched into the ocean, maybe from a ship or something, goes overboard, and he just starts swimming in one direction that he thinks there might be land. And as he's swimming, you hear this voiceover of his thoughts, where he's saying, "God, God, help me, just help me find land. Help me, if you help me, I'll give everything, all the treasures, my whole, everything I own, I'll give it to you." And he goes on swimming desperately, and then he sees way, way off in the distance, just the tiniest little sign of what he thinks may be land. And he says, okay, Lord, 80%. I'll give you 80% of everything I own." And then he goes further, and then it's 50, not any less than 50% as he gets closer to land. Back to, from Burt Reynolds to Xu Yun. And so just as a farmer who sows soybeans does not expect to harvest melons, we must not expect, when we commit selfish or immoral or injurious acts, to harvest spiritual purity. Neither can we hope to hide from our misdeeds by removing ourselves from the location in which we committed them, or to assume that time will expunge the record of them. Yeah, I guess there still are people who do bad things and then get out of Dodge and somehow think that that takes care of the matter. Sounds childish. Never may we suppose that if we just ignore our misdeeds long enough, people whom we have injured will conveniently die, taking to the grave with them our need to atone for the damage we have caused. It is our good deeds that we must bury, not our victims or broken promises. And then, so that was the first prerequisite of Zen training, is appreciating the law of, and believing in the law of causality. The law of causation. One who fully, completely believed in the law of causation would never cheat in any way, because the law of causation means that we can't ever get an advantage that we won't lose someday. That is, we can't get away with something that then we won't have to pay for. Pay for is not the best way of putting it. It's the way I understand causation is that it functions as a balancing of accounts, a squaring of accounts. There's no one, at least in Zen, we don't believe there's anyone up in the sky. There's no God. There's no karma committee that is set about to make sure that you pay for what your misdeeds. It's more like physics. Just if you go against the way, the Tao, then there will be a reckoning, a balancing of accounts in the future. Here too, as we said earlier, it doesn't even have to get into the realm of morality. It's just a matter of going against the way of things, the Tao. When we lead with the ego, to act out of self-interest because it is inherently out of balance, that itself, just acting on the impulses that of self-interest, that is out of balance with the way, and so then later things will have to come back into balance. I still remember from middle school, junior high, our science teacher was trying to simplify Einstein's theory of relativity in a way that our little minds could grok it. And he said that it's like what Einstein said, it was if we had a pole that we were pushing out into space, an infinitely long pole, and we pushed it and pushed it and pushed it for years and centuries and pushed out. Eventually, it would come back and hit us in the back, this pole. A premise of all this is that time, as such as we understand it, does not exist. That it's, or to put it a different way, it's only a matter of time before the way in which we act out of balance will come back and correct itself. Now, the second of the prerequisites for Zen training is accepting rules of discipline. As to the second requirement, I will tell you sincerely that there can be no spiritual progress without morality and the fulfillment of religious duty. Discipline is the foundation upon which enlightenment rests. Yasutani Roshi made this point as well. He, in talking about the three essentials of practice, the three essentials are the precepts, Zazen, and enlightenment. And he would refer to the precepts as the foundation. Discipline, Xu Yun says, regulates our behavior and makes it unchanging. Steadiness becomes steadfastness, and it is this which produces wisdom. The Shurangama Sutra, this is one of the great Mahayana sutras, Mahayana Buddhist sutras, clearly teaches us that mere accomplishment in meditation will not erase our impurities. Even if we were able to demonstrate great proficiency in meditation, still, without adherence to discipline, we would easily fall into Mara's evil realm of demons and heretics. Mara, for those of you who are new, Mara is a kind of a Buddhist devil that figures into popular Buddhism in a popular level among people who are not as educated, but also people like Xu Yun, who certainly was educated, but lived in a simpler time where such things as Mara were more meaningful. In our psychological culture here in the United States, I think for most people, this is a kind of a stretch to think of this impersonation of evil called Mara. But it can be useful as a kind of a myth for some people. And then he tells a story where he looks at sort of the etiquette aspect of training rules. Some of these sesshin rules, for example, can be considered a form of etiquette, but not just arbitrary niceties, but amenities, forms of conduct that, enable us to live together and function together more smoothly and harmoniously. And this story I will tell, because I got to at least tell one or two to give you a sense of the man, Xu Yun, and what was meaningful to him. It once happened that in the state of Kashmir, a poisonous earth dragon lived in a cave near a monastery of 500 arhats. Arhat means deeply enlightened ones. This dragon terrorized the region and made people's lives miserable. Every day the arhats would assemble, and together they would try to use the power of their collective meditation to drive away the dragon. But they always failed. The dragon simply would not leave. Then one day a Mahayana Chan monk happened to stop at the monastery. Here he's bringing in this basic distinction between the Mahayana branch of Buddhism and the Theravada branch of Buddhism. Zen is part of the Mahayana. And here we're going to see how the Mahayana monk takes care of things where the Theravadan arhats failed. So the arhats complained about this terrible dragon and asked the monk to join them in meditation, to add the power of his meditation to theirs. But this Chan monk merely smiled at them and went directly to the poisonous dragon's cave. So he stood in the cave entrance and he called to the dragon, "Wise and virtuous sir, would you be kind enough to depart from your lair and find refuge in a more distant place?" "Well," said the dragon, "since you have so politely asked, I will accede to your request and depart forthwith." And then Xu Yun says, "The dragon, you see, had a fine sense of etiquette." So away he went. From their monastery, the arhats watched all this in absolute astonishment. Surely this monk possessed miraculous samadhi powers. As soon as the monk returned, the arhats gathered around him and begged him to tell them about these wonderful powers. "I did not use any special meditation or samadhi," said the monk. "I simply kept the rules of discipline, and these rules stipulate that I must observe the minor requirements of courtesy as carefully as I observe the major requirements of morality." So then Xu Yun helps us see, we can see that the collective power of 500 arhats, meditation, samadhi are sometimes not the equal of one monk's simple adherence to the rules of discipline. This is not as far-fetched as it seems if you consider that that the mind is so highly sensitive to disturbances of every kind, people who've done a lot of sitting know that sometimes the tiniest influence from the environment, especially from people around us, can create some waves, this little disturbance in the mind. And that's why we're so conscientious about having people cooperate with these guidelines. Anyone who has gotten very deep and close to a true samadhi state knows that the mind is like a sensitive instrument that's picking up on data from all sides. And besides that, there's also just the habit force of reacting to people and things. This is why, for example, we plead with people not to, when writing notes in Sesshin, not to put any anger in the notes, because this can really be upsetting to people in Sesshin, even more than outside Sesshin. It's bad enough outside Sesshin. I've heard stories of people living together where, rather than, let's say, someone... here's a good one from staff life. Someone leaves their dirty dishes in the sink, or doesn't dry their dishes or something, and someone else, I'm talking about in a rooming house, or someone else will pin a note in the kitchen, clean up your goddamn dishes or something. This is not a way to live in harmony with other people, by writing notes like this. And it's the same in Sesshin. In Sesshin, we see when the mind is deprived of so much conversation and input, when the mind is in such a simplified state, it becomes very tender, very sensitive, and little things from the outside can really generate create problems in the mind. So it's a mindfulness practice in Sesshin to consider the effect of what we're doing and what we're saying, what we're writing. But mostly in Sesshin, it's doing what we're doing. It's a matter of consideration, of considering others' welfare. Xu Yun continues, if you ask why should strict attention to discipline and courtesy be necessary if the mind has attained a non-judgmental state, why should an honest and straightforward person even need to continue to practice Zen? I would ask such a person, is your mind so secure that if the lovely goddess of the moon were to come down to you and embrace you with her naked body, would your heart remain undisturbed? And you, if someone without having cause were to insult or to strike you, would you feel no anger and resentment? Can you be certain that you would always resist comparing yourself to others, or that you would always refrain from being judgmental? Can you be sure that you would always know right from wrong? Now, if you are absolutely certain that you would never yield to temptation, that you would never err at all, then open your mouth and speak loud and clear. Otherwise, don't even whisper a lie. So, this inner work that we call Zazen, or Zen meditation more broadly, this work reveals to us how subtle our egoistic reactions can be, and how subtle the residual forms of egotism are in the mind. We just keep, over the years, we just keep discovering more and more layers of greed in its many forms. Anger in its many forms, delusion in its many forms. So taking the precepts seriously is something that naturally develops as we see how many ways we can go astray mentally, if not in our actions and our behavior. And then he goes to the third prerequisite of Zen training, faith. Having a firm belief in one's Buddha, one's true self. Please know that faith is the mother, the nourishing source of our determination to submit to training and to perform our religious duties. If we seek liberation from the travails of this world, we must have a firm faith in the Buddha's assurance that each living being on earth possesses enlightened wisdom and therefore has the potential of realizing enlightenment. What prevents us from realizing this wisdom and attaining enlightenment? The answer is that we simply do not have faith in the Buddha's assurances. We prefer to remain in ignorance of this truth, to accept the false as genuine, and to dedicate our lives to satisfying all our foolish cravings. Roshi Kapil used to often say, faith means to have faith that when the Buddha said that what is common to all beings is this enlightened nature, that he was neither mistaken nor lying. This is one way of understanding faith. Faith in our true nature, our enlightened, our intrinsically enlightened, pure nature. This is somewhat like the doctrine of original sin turned inside out. It's the doctrine of original enlightenment. This is what we confirm through awakening. That's the great value of awakening, is it confirms. We know after awakening, we know that we and all beings are equally endowed with this enlightened nature. And this has a very positive effect on our practice. We never again will be crippled by doubt once we have seen into this, clearly into this enlightened nature. We still may be blindsided by old habit forces of greed, anger, and delusion. But what is removed is the doubt in our inherent purity. Xu Yuan says, we prefer to remain in ignorance of this truth, to accept the false as genuine. Let's bring this right into the nuts and bolts of actual practice, sitting. To accept the false as genuine is to choose our thoughts over the practice. This is a choice that we face over and over and over and over and over again in our sitting. We notice that our mind has slipped into thoughts, and instead of just dropping them, going back to the practice, we linger in the thoughts. That is what Xu Yun means in a very specific way, accepting the false as genuine, going with our thoughts. So we get to make this choice over and over again, hundreds of times a day, thousands of times a day in Sesshin. We make this choice. Thoughts or mu? Thoughts or breath? That is the substance of this work of meditation, making that choice. It says, and we prefer to dedicate our lives to satisfying all our foolish cravings. This is the driving force behind the lives of most people is gain, personal gain, self-interest. I say most people, there are plenty of exceptions. But how many of us can say that our life is really dedicated to getting free of these most basic egoistic drives? This doesn't mean that we have to give up all thought of making money. We need money to support families, to do other things. It's all a matter of the mix. To what degree are we dominated by self-interest rather than something much bigger, more magnanimous, more whole? Again, self-interest creates painful karma because it's out of balance with the way. I suppose only in the purest zazen are we entirely free of the taint of egoism. It's a very, very pure state. Other than that, we all have degrees of to work with, degrees of self-interest, and it's a long process, this purifying process. But it all takes place in our awareness of what is going on in the mind, moment by moment. That's the wonderful thing about zazen, and especially sesshin, is there's such a it's so clear, our choice from moment to moment. Our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.